Hi, everybody. How are you today? How are things in your world? Have you seen anything good, anything you like, anything that's stuck in your brain and will be there for the rest of your life? I hope so. I hope that you have memories as dear to you as the heroes you grew up with, and as dear as the co-host that I have with me. As always, I have my radio intercept officer, Federico Frazan. I am Mark Chaffardini, and you are listening to the Go See Talk podcast. This is a very special day. We are kicking off a brand new podcast. We are calling this the Two O's in Goose.
Join two high-flying friends with low standards as they navigate the cinematic airspace.
For 5 weeks, you're going to fly against the best fighter pilots in the world.
I decked my ass. We nailed that son of a bitch. Ah,
you guys really are cowboys.
These knuckleheads are the two O's in Goose.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, you kill me.
You really do.
Welcome everybody. Federico, how are you? How's things in your world?
Hello, Mark, and hello, everybody. Welcome to the 2O's party slash podcast slash club. I'm Federico, and all I can say is that I'm really excited to finally do this with you, Mark.
Excellent.
I mean,
excellent.
It was only yesterday that I got actually wrote you an email. It feels like it was yesterday that I wrote you an email asking to be a contributor to your website. And you replied with a set of guidelines that I really didn't understand about the rating. And to this day, I can understand them, but it's okay. but a couple of years later, that collaboration has turned into a very good friendship. And for that, I'm grateful.
Well, I love your style. I love your work ethic. I love the things that you like. I think we have a lot of things in common. We're kindred spirits, but we are thrilled to be opening the world up to this little corner of the web that we want to carve out. And as film fans, we want to say you're going to be up there with the best of the best film fans. So let's kick this off hardcore. We have no agenda, no prior engagements. All we know is we are two knuckleheads rattling off about the good and the bad. Federico, yes, it's so funny. Yeah, got an email from you yesterday just talking about some spitballing about what we might be speaking about today. Why don't we're halfway through the year. What do you say we run down what the best of the best in the first half of this year is? You want
that's a great
one or two.
Yeah,
titles?
sure. Yes. Actually, my year's kind of been a little hectic. I actually haven't been to the movies as much as I wanted to. I'm mostly dedicated to watching like TV shows. Because they're like easier to watch in a whole run. But the last time I went to the movies, this is going to be, I mean, it's very ironic that we're going to kick off with a little, I think it's a very, it's going to be a disagreement. But I did not like Indiana Jones and the Dials of Destiny. I did not like that movie. I had my hopes up, of course, because I love Indiana Jones. But the thing is that it didn't feel like an Indiana Jones, and it wasn't supposed to feel like an Indiana Jones movie. I didn't find it to be very entertaining. I think it didn't help that I had watched The Last Crusade the day before. So that did not help, of course. Crystal Skull, I'm fond of that movie. Not many people like it, but I like it a bit. I love the CGI of the movie. It was great. I mean, the aging stuff just like blew my mind the very first scene. What really didn't do it for me was Phoebe Waller-Bridge. I think that she plays the same role she's always playing in her films and TV shows, whatever they are. But all in all, it wasn't like I didn't like it as much as I wanted to. I mean, it was supposed to pay tribute to Harrison Ford and all the images that we have in Indiana Jones that we built throughout like almost 40 years. And I think it didn't hold up. I was expecting something else. And I know you liked it. So I want to hear what you think of it.
Well, that is the inner child in me saying, yes, give me more indie. Yeah. And I'm going to have to introduce this as little baby Chelsea. She's the youngest film critic in the Go See Talk headquarters. Hope you can hear. We might have to record something over this. But I think that I went in with super low expectations. I think Crusade is my favorite. I do think that Temple Doom is actually the best constructed, best assembled, probably the best Indiana Jones movie, like top to bottom. I think that each film has a lot of merits. They do have some problems, but I think that from a completeness level, Doom is the best. I think that
really
Crusade is, and even the music, I think the music in Doom is probably the best. Mm-hmm. It's the most dynamic and flavorful. Crusade is by far and away my favorite, even though watching it, it does feel a little thin and weak. Yes, I said thin and weak about that one, but compared to Raiders. But I think that there's people had talked about a fourth Indiana Jones movie. I don't know what they're talking about. There's no such movie exists in the history of the world. So this Dial of Destiny is the fourth one. But I liked it because I had been, not to say I got suckered into the rumor mill and the trolling, but I had just heard so much bad press about the movie even before it came out, and all this, like, Kathleen Kennedy is she's trying to sink the ship and all this bad stuff, and these websites, and I just really was anticipating the worst. But I found that all the things that maybe had sounded bad about Phoebe Waller-Bridge's character and how she was going to be too headstrong and condescending, and the fact that they might have scrapbooked, so shot basically five movies and tried to put the best pieces together, I didn't feel like there was anything that was disingenuous or didn't gel well. I would say that it was a little too long. You could probably trim about a half hour out of it, but I think there were some elements that the beginning was great. The de-aging stuff was, actually, I didn't like it quite as well as you, but I did like how it did feel like an older style Indiana Jones film. I think the Tangier cart ride is probably the finest action sequence in the entire series. I might just be coming off the high of watching it recently, but I still think that there's enough oomph behind everything that it just feels like, it caters to modern audiences. It feels like an advancement of the character, and it just it's an updated action sequence. So I think that there's so much to love and take away, and I don't think that they beat you over the head with nods and winks to previous efforts. It was tasteful, and I just felt like our character, as flawed as he is, had a pretty good send-off. So I liked it. I'm still kind of like, I'm still on a high from it, but I will want to see this again.
All right. I mean, the thing is that if you remove Indiana Jones from the whole equation, it's the same. It's not an Indiana Jones film. That's my beef with it. And about the soundtrack, I don't know if it was the cinema where I saw it, but I didn't hear the Indiana Jones theme as much as I wanted to. In that regard, it feels like it's not Indiana Jones. And for the record, I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is a perfect movie, and that's the best Indiana Jones. But my favorite, it's Doom, definitely, but I think Raiders of the Lost Ark is far better. It's a perfect movie. It's a very definition of a perfect movie.
Well, there's something about the end that always just feels a little weak. I don't know if you've ever read the books by what's his name, the guy who did the Da Vinci Code. He has
Dan Brown.
He has quite, like, his stories are so interesting and well structured, and I just feel that when you get to the end, there's nothing that can sort of sustain the ride and the hype, and then at the end, like, it just kind of like it teeters out when it should have been fireworks or something. So I kind of feel that even though Raiders is a great film, I will not knock it in the least, there's just something about the end of it just seems a little Well, maybe Chelsea's saying it better. I'm bored. It's flat. No, that's not the case. No, I think that I love it dearly. But anyway, but you know, I think that was a good one to move on from, because if we both go toe to toe in, I would say in tandem with the best and, you know, and praising things, yeah, then we're never going to get anywhere. We won't be film fans. So one good one to like tee off and be divergent. So what's your next one? What's something that you were?
Well, as I said, I haven't been to the movies that much. I saw a couple ones on VOD, and as always, I'm sticking to horror, and I'm going to mention two ones that I liked and the two ones that I didn't like very much. I did not like The Pope's Exorcist. I think it's a very disposable film. It worked to tell the story of this very famous priest that is like the Vatican's exorcist, but aside from that, it's not a very good film. And I saw Renfield that I started to like. I think the character of Renfield is very good, but I think that Nick Cage is like trapped in a film that he's not very comfortable with. I did not like that one. But the two ones I liked were Evil Dead Rises. I'm not a fan of Evil Dead. Yeah, you guys, if you can see Mark right now, he's like really shaking his head. But well, Evil Dead Rises, I liked Evil Dead Rises. I think it's a good sequel that doesn't necessarily have to be a sequel to the first like reboot that Fede Alvarez did in 2013. And it's gory, it's well built, and it pulls some strings that the previous films didn't. And the other one that I liked is called The Horror in the High Desert 2. This is found footage film. It's a sequel to a previous film that was made like a couple of years ago, 2020, I think, during the pandemic. And this one, he just like follows up on the original story. And that is a very scary film. I think found footage films are the scariest for me. And as always, I enjoyed it. I complimented him on Twitter and I said that he scared the crap out of me, and that's always a good thing. So those are the movies that I've seen recently that I like and I didn't like in terms of horror. And how about you?
Well, you know, I have to give points to Evil Dead Rise for getting out of the cabin, you know, if trying to find a way to tell the story and make it bigger and work in our world. But it still basically was like the same sort of small scale format, and it didn't really play with things like, have you seen Antlers?
Yeah, okay. I like the film.
Okay, and I did too, for the point that it was trying to make about mental illness and trying to tell a bigger picture. But I don't think that this really, Evil Dead Rise was, I wouldn't even say shock value to have shock value, because I think the remake, Fede Alvarez's 2013 effort, was a lot more shocking. And
yeah, it was.
That was more like a straight up reboot. Or retreading. I just didn't think that there was really a purpose to this. And I didn't really get anything out of it. I mean, I think that if you think of movies like what Edgar Wright or Romero tries to do with sort of a social commentary, I love that subliminal underpinning that kind of gives story more depth. I just didn't really feel anything from this. And then just trying to tie it back to the cabin in the beginning of it, I didn't really see how those two things went together. So it left me scratching my head more than just feeling, you know, I'll watch movies that make you feel bad as long as, you know, it's well done and you feel good about it afterwards. But I just didn't feel good about it. So, but I think that a movie I really kind of liked but felt like it was in the wrong setting was Megan. Or M3GAN, it had all the elements that I felt should have worked. You know, technology and robots gone rogue, you know, kids looking for a friend, you know, put upon family, like nice little elements and things that make kind of a horror or a thriller movie work. but it just felt like it should have been an episode of Black Mirror instead of a film. And I just, I had this, this notion that it was just sort of overstaying its welcome. And Chelsea agrees.
I actually liked Megan, even though I think the film had previously been made in the Child's Play reboot, because it's also about AI like taking over the world. But I think that those kinds of subgenres and subjects and themes are very appealing to younger audiences. But I mean, like Child's Play, the original Child's Play, it wouldn't work today with the basis of this guy's a demon that serial killer just like releasing to a doll. So I think that's why the Child's Play reboot works so well. And I just see this one as like a follow-up with like a female robot, if you want to call it that. And I just think like she's creepy, man. I mean, if you see the whole territory of her technology, it can get under your bones. And there are just a couple of scenes that did it for me, like just the pulling the ear scene, and like just like she didn't cause the kids like to be run over with the SUV, but she basically did all the work. It's at the same time, we can all agree that it's a very ridiculous film, because it's very ridiculous. I mean, the whole dancing scene, it's creepy for some, and then for others it's just laughable. But I think that it's the same like thing with horror, that some horror movies just like want to entertain you and just want to make you laugh. I mean, I was in the movie theater just like cracking up, and I think that's what you're supposed to do with the films like Megan. That's it.
I liked Renfield for the fact that it didn't care about being serious. I mean, the fact that the part when Nick Cage is trying to put himself back together after being burnt, and he just looks like bad gremlin puppetry from, you know, Joe Dante era. It didn't care about making a statement. It just wanted to talk and be heard. I don't know if that makes a lot of sense, but I like that for that aspect. And, you know, there's something about just fun for fun's sake. I mean, that's kind of why, and just, you know, trying to make this list, whether you saw it in the theater, whether you saw it on VOD, anything that really came out in 2023 is really up for grabs. So it could be anything. And so I think this list is, we started off doing the best, and now it's kind of delved into free for all. I love it. I love it. This is totally out of the blue, but I really love Super Mario Brothers. I had a good time with that. And I think that there was so much of the movie that was just making me laugh from the point of view of sound. You know, like when the music kicks in at certain points, there are little cues to make you think and sort of get back to the DNA of what it was like to be a kid. And I love those little elements. And it wasn't, you know, it was not like Shrek, where there was a lot of adult humor. It was just an across-the-board kids movie that just, it was a great time at the cinema.
That's good. I haven't seen that one. I have to see it. I was in the Super Mario world in Universal Studios in California. And when I saw the children's faces over there, I could just imagine them like seeing the movie and a big, big, big screen the way they were always supposed to, because the film that we got in the 90s was not a very good movie. That film should not exist at all. But yeah, good for you, man. I have to see that one.
Well, yes,
I should have seen it in theaters, but I'm going to see that one.
Let's record a whole podcast about it when you've seen it, because I'm amped to see it again. I don't buy very much these days, but I know that when it comes out, I'm going to get it. And being a Brian Tyler fan, I've already pre-ordered the vinyl. And I think that he's a rainmaker. Everything he touches is just brilliant. So,
yeah.
Well, you know, why don't we take a small sidestep? You recently visited the States, went to a couple movie studios. Why don't you share your experiences? What'd you see? What'd you love? What was the happiest one for you as a film fan?
That was great. I mean, Los Angeles for a film fan, it's like Disney World for a film fan. But it really depends on whether you like the old part of Hollywood or whether you like the new stuff. I mean, it's not the same going through the Netflix building, because it really is the Netflix building, than, I mean, that walking through Burbank and realizing that you're in Warner Brothers land, basically. I made sure that I visited all the four major studios. I went to Sony Studios, I went to Paramount Studios, I went to Warner Brothers, and of course went to Universal Studios, which has the studio tour that you get to walk through the back lots or what remains of them. The things that I remember the most, because you go through a lot, I was excited to visit the Barbra Streisand scoring stage, because it's this very historic building where John Williams recorded like basically everything in his career. And it's just like you imagine that. I mean, it's like 100 years old and it's pristine. The acoustics are incredible. That's on Sony, if I remember well. Then Warner Brothers has like a big part of the tour. It consists of you being able to go through exhibits and going through experiences. It has a lot of gift shops. Not the other studios, basically don't have none. And Paramount and Universal are just like classic because of what they are. In Paramount, you go through you step inside Hitchcock's office and you go through this. I mean, it's, you can sit in Forrest Gump's chair or something like that. I don't remember it well. You can see the cars from Cobra Kai, the cars from the Goldbergs, and the cars from Breaking Bad. I mean, in regards to props, there's a lot of them. And what else did I do anyway? Let me think. I went to the New Beverly, which is Quentin Tarantino's theater. They were showing a double feature of Blaxploitation that I didn't find tickets to. It's almost impossible to find tickets to watch those films. And all in all, I think LA is, it's everything you can think of. It's like decadence, and it's dirty, and Hollywood Boulevard, it's like, it's terribly dirty, but I think that's what Hollywood is today. I mean, Chinese Grauman's theater is terribly dirty, and there's not a lot of whole people there, and just like taking pictures, and it's not what I imagined. But I think there's no other way to put it, that LA is just like the way it has to be today. It's not the same Hollywood. Hollywood's not the same it was like 50 years ago. And that's okay. That's my experience in California, of course.
Well, there's nothing wrong with the things we love and our heroes having a little bit of tarnish. I mean, speaking about Indiana Jones and Clint Eastwood, I mean, these guys are up in their ages and still being able to surprise, entertain, and delight us. But I went to the Paramount Studio tour. I think that's probably my favorite studio of all time. I mean, just the lineage and the backlog of films that they put out, Hunt for Red October and Indiana Jones films. And I even saw a lot of those props. I, as dumb as it is, I really like G.I. Joe Rise of Cobra. And when I saw one of those warheads in the prop department, I would have gone to jail breaking that case open and taking it just to have something of Paramount. But, I probably should aim a little higher though. But I thought one of the greatest things about that trip for me was we saw this little alleyway. It was sort of a dead end alleyway between two lots or two sets. And it was where they shot that scene in Top Gun where Tom Cruise is talking to
Kevin McGillis. That's right. With a white fence.
Exactly. Yeah. It was like, wait, you're... And just that little bit of movie magic. Oh man, it was worth the trip. So that really spoke to me as a film fan. And then Warner Brothers was great. We learned a bunch of terms and stuff. We saw how they they did one set that was used to sort of be a back. There was a part in The Last Samurai where Tom Cruise was getting across a bridge, and then, you know, then they dutied that up and changed it up. It was like it was used in another movie. You just wouldn't know it. And the idea of bush carts and how they are able to turn things over and like just the tricks, you know, these little things that craftsmen work their entire lives to put on screen. And now it's on screen forever. And we're talking about it 100 years later. So
exactly.
I'm happy for you. It sounds like a really great trip. I loved your pictures on Instagram. I don't know if I got to like every single one of them, but I liked the majority of them. They were great.
Thank you, brother.
Well, that's great. Yeah, I think, and that's the whole reason that we're here. Paramount made Top Gun, and our entire podcast is based on the two O's in Goose. I think it's a really fun and fitting tagline and name of a podcast for us to just ramble and have fun.
Yeah. So, I just saw Maverick the other day again.
And what'd you think?
That's a great film. I don't know if I could say that Tom Cruise saved the movies. I think it's it's too much.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just fun. It just works. It's emotional. It doesn't feel like a sequel at all. I mean, it doesn't have the tackiness that Top Gun had back then, but it's just fun. It's very exciting. Yeah, I liked it. The very first scene of the film just like fills you up, man. Yeah, that guy has some balls, man.
Yeah, and you know that also speaks highly to the music too. I mean, Federico and I are huge film score fans, and I think that it's kind of tough to know who had what role in this when you credit the score to four people: Lauren Balfe, Lady Gaga, Hans Zimmer, and Harold Faltermeyer, the godfather of the first movie soundtrack. But you know, there's just something about, I would say that everything in that movie works. And in a way, I'm gonna go back and speak a little more highly about The Dial of Destiny. I think that it works in a way that I feel actually more passionate about a sequel to this one than I do for Top Gun Maverick. And I think they're both walking the same fine air where
that's broad, man.
Yeah, well, that's what I believe. I believe you're actually helping, you're not say paying homage. I think that you are actually getting a sizable narrative with the people that you fell in love with. I mean, and granted, there's some things about, you know, Top Gun, you know, how do you continue the legacy of Goose? Well, you do it with Rooster. How do you continue the legacy of Indiana Jones? Well, there's no Henry Jones Sr. There's very little Sala. But, you know, you work that into the story. And I had a great time. So, yeah, I watched, funny enough, my wife was watching it on Amazon Prime. I was like, I've got the 4K in the living room. Let's go get that. But good times. So what else? I remember, let's see. Have you gotten into any Apple TV movies?
Yeah, not movies. I think Apple TV is the best service you can try right now, but not in movies. I haven't seen much movies because today I don't watch much movies outside of the movie theater. I think it doesn't speak highly of me, but I have to get more into watching movies. But there are two shows that I saw recently on Apple TV that I just have to recommend, which are Silo, season one of Silo. That's a sci-fi adventure that, I mean, it starts very good. Yeah, it gets a bit draggy during the second part, but it just ends on a high note that it just makes you excited. And I know you like Ted Lasso. I know you're a Ted Lasso fan, and if you like Ted Lasso, then Shrinking is like the best show you can watch today. I mean, that show was very feel good. It's exceptionally written. Every line of dialogue is like a boost of energy. It just works so well, and Harrison Ford is like amazing in the show.
Yeah, I think it's a distant cousin to Ted Lasso because Brett Goldstein, who plays Roy Kent, is like the writer of this show. And man, that it just blew me away. In every episode was like essential to the series. And I don't like Jason Segel, but this one is his best role to date. I love that show.
I've seen Shrinking. Shrinking, I love. I'm glad you brought that up. It does feel about as emotionally warm and satisfying as Ted Lasso. I've only gotten through about 5 episodes of Silo, and I'm in the draggy part of it where it's okay. Very difficult when sets don't have windows and you just feel like, I wouldn't even say Stockholm syndrome, because I don't feel in love with my captor. I actually don't like my captor watching Silo. I'm like, just get me out of this. Is there hope? Is there something? So basically you've told me that it ends on a high note. So I will endure.
Yeah. I don't know if you like the ending, because it can be like very controversial. But it's just promising. I mean, Rebecca Ferguson is very good in the lead. And it's not the best show of 2023. Okay, it's not the best show of 2023. We can all say it's Succession, of course. But it's good for a sci-fi show. We don't get much of those. I mean, we should get more sci-fi. I think it's more expensive, and that's the reason we don't get much. But just for starters, I mean, Apple TV has done some great sci-fi. I love The Invasion. I think it's like a sin that they didn't continue with that one. I have to see more. I have to see the Tom Hanks Android film. I think it's on Apple TV. I haven't seen that one.
Oh, yeah, but Finch. That's actually, I would recommend that.
Okay, good.
I'm gonna came out last that. Year, but yeah.
But in regards to sci-fi, Silo is the best thing you can do right now. Definitely.
Well, if I can steal a line from the Skittles, Skittles tagline from the 80s, Skittles makes mouth happy. I would say, yes, Apple TV makes mouth happy. That sounds like a terrible advertisement. But no, that's...
Yeah, we won't get paid for that.
Well, I think, you know, it's funny, trying to come up with this idea for the podcast. We love film so much. I don't think that I can go a minute or an hour, walk down the street, drive my car without something that either reminds me of a quote, reminds me of something that was in a movie, or like I was driving on the highway and I was going through between two semi-trailers and all of a sudden I go, are you crazy? Don't go between them. Go between them. Are you crazy? And so I love it. So where I'm going with that is trying to figure out the direction for this podcast. I put this little fun montage with them. I'm going to play for everybody in a second. It's indulgent. It's fun, but it kind of shows you the kind of movies that Federico and I love, and we hope you enjoy it.
This is Jack Burton in the Pork Chop Express, and I'm talking to whoever's listening out there. Like I told my last wife, I says, honey, I never drive faster than I can see. Besides that, it's all in the reflexes.
It can't be bargained with, it can't be reasoned with, and it absolutely will not stop.
Yeah. Stick around.
Plaque for the alternates is down in the ladies' room.
Oh, Jesus! Oh, you kill me. You really do.
Are you telling me you built a time machine out of a DeLorean?
How do I look?
Like a hood ornament.
Do you want to talk about the symphony event that you went to?
Back to the orchestra?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's an event that's held on a yearly basis here. The director is this very young guy who
whose father is a very important director. His father actually has an event that's called Paramount in Concert. I also went to that one, and you would have loved it because it's Paramount, of course, and they play music from the Paramount films. Personally, I didn't like the selection. I think they should have gone for something else. But they play The Godfather, they play Forrest Gump, and of course they play Top Gun. But just like the guitar work on that concert was horrible. That's why I did not speak about it. But his son's event, which is called Back to the Orchestra, it's very well executed. I think he's very talented, and it's because you can sense that he doesn't want to make a whole show out of it. He doesn't use footage from the movies on the back of the screen of the show. I don't think he's allowed to, of course, but. All of that energy that you would get from watching the footage on the screen, you get in the music that he plays. He does arrangements for like 80s shows that you will love. I mean, he did one for Alf that just like brought tears to my eyes, man. It was amazing. And that's not a show that you remember the music, you know. You cannot like hum the intro of that show. And he did a great job. That was very unexpected. And I actually have a very good relationship with him. And the first event that I went was in 2021. And I told him, I dare you to play the last 12 minutes of E.T. Because no one like does that. I mean, it's 12 or 16, I don't know. But those like 60 minutes of E.T., let's put it at 16, the music never stops. I mean, it has like very little to no dialogue. And it's on, I dare you to play that because people won't understand the importance of that. Because the whole suite, Escape, Chasing Goodbye, or things like that, I think it's called, just like goes through every mood in the E.T. film. And that was very emotional for me, of course. But all in all, I think it's an event that for 80s films lovers, that it's magic, man. He does a great work. And this year, he's going to do it again. But he's going to do everything. I think he's going to dedicate himself to playing like John Williams music because he does insert things that are not by John Williams. Like Back to the Future or Lord of the Rings or I don't know, TV shows or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and things like that. But I think this year he's going to do John Williams exclusively because I think that he wants to play John Williams scores, but since they're not from the 80s and they're not from like the adventure films, he's not like, he doesn't follow the theme of the concert. Because where do you put the Jaws soundtrack in Back to the Orchestra event. So I think that's what I'm going to do. But I wish he could like do that every 2 or 3 months because I would go to that concert. It's very emotional.
That's superb. I know the feeling that you get when you listen to film music. And hearing it live, I think there's just something magical about that because still don't know how you put a bassoon and a tuba and a harp together and the next thing you know, it's stuck in your head for decades and brings a tear to your eye every time you hear it. Just something, and you know, it's not even, you know, there's a thing that says movie music is not pure music because, you know, it's crafted to be an accompaniment to moving pictures, which is in a way manipulation. But you know, as I told Patrick Doyle, I don't mind being manipulated. When you do your job so damn well, I don't mind. Manipulate me all day of the week, every day of the week. And I love seeing it too because I watch those concerts and I go, I didn't know that instrument made that sound or that section and just how the power of the things coming together. work, and it, I mean, it's brilliant. I mean, I've seen both movies done live to picture, like Casablanca and Home Alone. But then I've also seen melodies. I know James Newton Howard came to do a melody of his music here at the Dallas Symphony. And to the point you were making earlier, some things you had the rights to show visuals to, some things you didn't, but it didn't matter because people were there for the music. You know,
absolutely.
It's not about the horse from Hidalgo. It's about the horns in Hidalgo. It's, you know, I can go on and on and on, but yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. On that note, have you heard any recent soundtracks that you like?
Not really, I would say. I think one of the, I'm going to use being a dad as an excuse that I haven't gotten to see that many. I kind of had to do a quick tally of what I'd seen, like, okay, we're halfway through the year. I've only seen about 10 things. And you know, that's a lot less than I would want to see. But I think maybe Tetris had a very interesting score. Lauren Balfe, again, he's definitely rising in the ranks, both for how it brought the Tetris theme into it, but then also charted a little new territory, but wasn't that much music in it. I think Super Mario Brothers was nice too. I think one that actually was, I was defeated by not feeling more from it, was Guardians of the Galaxy 3, because Tyler Bates did the first two scores, and then the holiday special, and now Guardians 3 was done by John Murphy, and there was just no oomph, no body, nothing emotional to it. And I'm not saying that's bad, or I was, you know, disappointed. It just, or it was the wrong move. It was something that wasn't there, and so that was kind of something that you would have wanted. And I will say that, from maybe to your point about Indiana Jones, there was a lot of what I call borrowed music in Dial of Destiny. I heard a lot of Crusade. Yeah, I heard a lot of, and not borrowed like Schindler's List or Saving Private Ryan. Although there was a part when Indy's riding a horse where it sounded like something was lifted from Minority Report, but there was just something, there was a lack of new material, I think. And listen, I'm not going to be quoted as as faulting John Williams, but I do think for a 2.5 hour movie, if the soundtrack only has 106 minutes or an hour and 6 minutes, that's just the new stuff. They don't even like try to weave the older themes in and expand. You know,
yeah,
like Williams is known to do in the credits, where he expands on his work. So again, disclaimer, I am not discrediting his work. I maybe share that with you. I didn't feel anything, but yeah,
this would have been his last film, right? It has to be his last film.
I think
he's retiring.
So. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Do you like the score for The Fablemans?
I did. And in a weird way, it was so tender. I think that there's a lot of, there's a lot of tenderness in AI. There's some real tenderness in parts of Minority Report. And I think that listening to The Fablemans and running right into Dial of Destiny, there's some string work, some piano work, and some, I would just call them bells, that plays real soft. And I think that's, I don't know, maybe that's his new flavor of the decade. You know, he's just getting away from the bombastic French horns and or trumpets or trombones. Anyway, yeah, I'm glad you brought up The Fablemans, because that's kind of a not very accessible film. I think that if you're a film fan and you kind of want to know about Spielberg and kind of what his what drove him, I was like, that's a pretty, you know, that's a pretty honest effort. But I'm also wondering, where was he going with some of the stuff, like, you know, at the end of the movie when he was, you know, shooting the video of that guy, that bully wasn't very nice to him. Like, what was the kind of the point?
Yeah, I did not get that. I think that's Tony Kushner, like, getting his hands on the story. It's not my favorite Spielberg film. I think that he owed it to himself to do it, because we all want to know what's the story behind the guy who created, like, these great films.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that I was expecting a little bit more about the Spielberg that I thought I knew.
Okay.
But I just have to accept that it's just, I wanted to see more of his movies, like if he got those ideas when he was a kid.
I got it. Like Lucas in Love or Shakespeare in Love.
Yeah.
Okay.
I just had to accept that. I mean, it's a very good film. It's not my favorite, but I think that he owed it to himself, and I just love the guy. I don't even know what his next film is going to be. I don't know what he's doing right now. But that, I mean, if he ends his career with this one, and I don't think he will, but if he does, I think it's a very good ending to what he did.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've kind of garnered this notion that now this is, the notion is bullshit, just like the opinion, but I've come to the sort of late game Spielberg conclusion that if it's a period piece, it's kind of a snore fest. And that doesn't mean that I'm knocking things like Schindler's List or Saving Private Ryan, but there's something about Lincoln and War Horse. Like for every one of those, it kind of puts me to sleep. But then I stand up and cheer for something like Ready Player One, which I kind of feel that anybody could have directed Ready Player One. There was no Spielberg charm to it. Just like I feel that the later day Tim Burton movies don't have a Tim Burton charm. And I don't know. I don't know what that means. Like, does it mean that they're not hungry anymore? Does it mean that they have too many yes men? Like this is a total parallel, but Wes Anderson, I didn't get his films until I saw Fantastic Mr. Fox. I saw that, Moonrise Kingdom, Grand Budapest Hotel, and I was like, this is great. Maybe what was I missing before? And then I saw Darjeeling Limited, and then Isle of Dogs, and now Asteroid City, and I just feel like, no, I'm not knocking him when I say this, but I think that there's a point where they're just getting to make the movies that they want, and it's, I'm not gonna say too self-indulgent, but if you think about,
you can say it. He's self-indulgent. Come on.
But think about like the control that Lucas had with the prequels. I was having a talk with a friend of mine last night after seeing Dial of Destiny, and it was this discussion about, well, a lot of people are knocking the new prequel trilogy or the sequel trilogy, and a lot of people are saying, well, George Lucas could have done better. And then my friend's point was like, do you not remember what happened with the prequels? Like, this is a guy who had full control, and he thinks that as bad as Rise of Skywalker is, he's like, I think that JJ stuck the landing as best he could, trying to sort of like take the things that were done in Force Awakens, and then whether you like it or not, kind of take The Last Jedi and then just sort of like meld them, and then just get to like, okay, can we just roll credits? Can we be done with this? So then people were just like, well, George, if George buys Lucasfilm back, what could he do? And my friend was like, probably the same thing.
Holy
he did.
No.
Probably the same thing he did with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, you know? So who knows? Who knows? But
yeah, I think it's identity. I mean, Spielberg has identity. With his films, I mean, there are films that you watch and you're definitely feeling that you're in a Spielberg film. I mean, Catch Me If You Can, for example, that it's like he strays away from his most comfy zone, which is like adventure, sci-fi, or thrillers or things like that, and he just like goes to a crime drama that has hints of comedy, and you still feel like you're in a Spielberg film. And West Side Story, I mean, could someone have made something as beautiful as that? I don't think so. And even so, it's the last part of his career. You don't feel like you're in a Spielberg film. With the Fableman, I mean, if you don't know that that's his story, maybe you don't feel like you're in a Spielberg film.
And I think that that identity, that that the one that you say is missing from the latest Tim Burton's films, you don't feel like you're watching Tim Burton's films. I mean, the way you felt when you were watching like Beetlejuice or Ed Wood or Mars Attacks. I don't know if current filmmakers have the power to like make a shape out of that identity and build a whole universe that makes you think that you're watching one of their films. I mean, Wes Anderson, like visually, or he, the aesthetics of his films are impressive. But in regards to his stories, you like identify that you're watching a film by Wes Anderson if it didn't have those visuals? I don't think so.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, the other one I watched was The French Dispatch, and I honestly had to speed through a lot of it because it just was like, oh, geez. And, you know, maybe there's a reason that everything you see is put on screen. And, you know, there's either an intent behind it, or maybe somebody had a power play that they, you know, the director couldn't step back from. Like, but there's a reason that things happen. Like, you know, going back to that Super Mario Brothers movie from the 80s, I remember John Leguizamo very vividly says, he goes, nobody sets out to make a bad movie. It's just things happen over the course. And then what you see is the product of that. So, I mean, and you know, movies really are a crapshoot. I mean, there's that famous saying that you make a movie three times. You make it once when you write it, once when you shoot it, and once when you edit it. And, you know, maybe there's two or three other iterations that, you know, that a film can take over the course of, you know, from the adaptation or
definitely
the process. Yeah. So, I mean, just be glad that anything gets made. But I think you said something that was very telling. There are probably directors or filmmakers who can't make what they want, or maybe don't have the backing, whether it's financial or trust or whatever it is, you know, the studios. I mean, I guess the more at stake something is, the more control something needs to have. And
it needs to have it. It needs to have it, mm-hmm. Of course, yeah.
So let's prep for landing. We're going to head now into the second half of the year. What's on your radar? What's your beacon home? What are you looking forward to?
Okay. Most? I'm going to mention five films that I'm looking forward to this year. Actually, I'm going to do six, five and a half, because one of them, I don't believe it's going to be very good, but I'm just excited to watch it. That one is it's The Exorcist Believer. I don't think that's going to be a good film. I mean, there's just no way that they could take the spirit of what was made like 50 years ago and do something good right now. I'm just putting a whole lot of trust in a guy that like made Halloween and like made his own version. And as good as the 2018 Halloween was, what he did after, just like, it disappointed a lot.
Okay, so everybody, Federico is calling out David Gordon Green, in case you hadn't figured that out.
Exactly. The ones that I'm very excited for are Oppenheimer, of course. I'm going to see that one, like the biggest screen like ever made, I wish. I'm excited for The Killer, which is David Fincher's like return to the genre that made him widely known. I'm excited, of course, for Killers of the Flower Moon, because aside from all the hype that film's gonna get when in award season and things like that, I think that Martin Scorsese feels comfortable with that. I mean, you can just like feel that he's gonna make a good film. I'm excited as well for the new Mission Impossible film, because I just love Mission Impossible, of course, and I just love his stunts. And I'm excited, of course, for Dune Part 2, because I love Dune Part 1. And just return to that world, just it's very exciting for me. Yeah, those are the ones. How about you?
Well, yeah, I see a connection between two of those picks. You got a Rebecca Ferguson headlining, who also headlined Silo. She's been really popping up and making a name for herself. She did. I think she was pretty great in Dr. Sleep that Shining
absolutely
sequel. I think that movie needs to get talked about more, but I share a couple of those, and in a way I with David Gordon Green, I liked Halloween 2018 quite a bit. I really did not like Halloween Kills, but I think that there was a whole Evil Dies Tonight thing, which was in a way a social commentary about public, the mob mentality and stuff like that.
That was good. I gotta admit that was good. Yeah.
But absolutely. I also think that I liked that in a way that there was the way they structured Halloween Ends to where there was kind of like a new blood. And in a way it was advancing the mythology without saying, haha, we're going to have five more spinoffs with this new guy. I think it was, I would say it's a pretty ballsy approach. And I could see why a lot of people didn't like it. I could see why a lot of people didn't like Halloween Kills, but I really have no hope for The Exorcist, so it's not on my list, but I did want to just bring up those two last films in his trilogy. But Oppenheimer, absolutely, for sure.
Yeah, if that film gets out to be good, we're going to have to swallow our tongues with that one.
Dune 2 is on my list, not as high as I would have expected, because I liked the first one a lot, and I went back to rewatch it again, and I didn't feel quite as fulfilled having seen it again. I remember the first time I watched it, it took me about 3 hours, because I kept taking it back, just kind of watching, watching 5 minutes and then watching that same 5 minutes again, because the set design was so good. The dialogue, the exchanges were so well structured. I mean, that part where Paul is being followed by the hunter seeker, and he hides in the hologram, just the world that they were able to build in a world that they thought was, too ambitious to put on film. And they thought it was, the death of cinema when David Lynch made it. So I think they've given it a new life and a respectable director to put his vision out there. But I think that there's something to be said about the killer is a good one. I like to joke that it's the sequel to the Snowman, or a prequel to the Snowman. But I'm pretty excited about The Creator. Gareth Edwards is The Creator, where John David Washington from Tenet, he is basically trying to protect this autonomous robot. Won't say too much more than that. Let's see what else. Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of hope for, not that sounds terrible. I don't have a whole lot of high points that I'm looking for towards the end of the year, not as big as the beginning of this year. I think that we just had some really good winners, some good ones right out of the gates. And I think I'm pretty fulfilled so far.
That's good, man. Probably you're gonna have to go back and watch some classics. I always like to go back and watch some old films that I like. For example, I watched one recently that I hadn't been able to watch. And that film marked me. I asked my dad if he had seen it, and he remembers watching that and just feeling broken after watching.
What film?
I'm talking about Testament. Have you seen Testament?
I don't think so.
It's it's the film that the story is about nuclear fallout after the U.S. gets attacked by a nuclear bomb. It's from the 80s. It stars a very young Kevin Costner and Rebecca De Mornay. And I have to say that I wasn't the same guy after watching that film for a couple of days.
Okay.
It's so sad. It's so heartbreaking. It had this power to impact me the way all films do. And I think that's why I just keep going back to the films. that I liked back then, films from the 60s, the 70s, and the 80s. And that's what I do when, because I don't find new films to be that engaging. I just wish like they could play some old films in the theater. I definitely like old cinema way better than I like music. But yeah, this one's I'm really excited for this one that I mentioned. Yeah,
that's great. Well, I find myself on a similar wavelength. I do kind of live in a bubble, and I'm not saying that the movies from the 80s or my youth were the best ever, but I think that there's something you appreciate about them. Now, here is a very fun way to, I think, to end the podcast. We all have guilty pleasures. We all have soft spots for things that we know people are going to laugh at. Mine, I'll tell you right now, are The Wizard, Mannequin, and Encino Man. You know, not great cinema at all, but I think that there's something to be said about growing up with fewer options. I think what I've done is I've appreciated something more seeing it repeatedly. And again, that's not saying it's good and not saying I'm giving it a pass, but I think that there's something that's been endeared to where, you know, I feel that we are in the age of disposable entertainment. You know, you literally stream anything from the past 120 years and then flick to something else, where when I was younger, I would go to a movie store, video place, rent something, spend $3.99, whatever, take it home. It's like, well, love it or leave it, I have to bring this back in 3 days. So, you know, there's only so many TV shows I can watch, can't speed through commercials, can't record your favorite shows. Just like, and I found myself just kind of digging into things that, you know, maybe on the first pass you go, man, it's not for me, but you give it a second or third and it's, I mean, maybe it's, I'm putting myself through undue punishment to save $3, but I think that there's something to be said about just going back to something that feels comfortable or something that it kind of has won you over. And you know, a lot like films or a lot like people, I think that films change over time, and it's because we as people change. So something that wasn't appealing to you as a kid is something that's appealing. And I'll give you a perfect example. Temple of Doom. The beautiful scene at the end when Indy reaches for his gun and tries to shoot the two swordsmen like he did in the first movie, right? So he has no gun. Why does he have no gun? Because Willie dropped it out of the car in the beginning, in the chase. In a way, that's the opposite of Chekhov's gun. You know, you see a gun in the first act, it has to go off in a third act. That's the opposite. He has no gun, so therefore the payoff of him not having a gun is him having to find another way to get through. So okay. I like that.
I'll give you that connection, yeah.
But then I think that there's something that I love about this in Crusade. You know, Indy's dangling from the crevice. Henry Sr. saves him. And a man who has devoted his entire life to finding the Grail, to Grail lore, sees it's consuming his son in about like 4 seconds. And when he utters Indiana, let it go. I just love that he puts importance on the things that are most important to him. Where I think as a young kid, I still loved it and I love that movie, but I think there's things that you appreciate and you see differently. It's a different set of eyes. So I don't know.
Absolutely.
Well, everybody, we have hit the runway, we hit the net, we are getting cheered on by ground crew and people in the tower. Ghost Rider, this was one fun buzz past the tower. What'd you think, Federico? Did you have a good time?
Yeah, I had a great time. I had a lot of high expectations for this one, and I just gotta say that it's much better to go this like no agenda at all, just like talking about movies. I think we should just like do this every time that we sit around and talk. It's way more fun, but no more Dial of Destiny, please.
Oh, okay,
I won't stand that again. I don't like that movie. Hopefully we'll catch around and talk about Oppenheimer and some stuff like that. No Dial of Destiny.
Judge's ruling. Yeah, we're gonna allow that. All right, okay. Everyone, keep your eyes and ears open for the next installment of the Two O's and Goose podcast, and we will catch you next time.
Bye-bye.
You kill me. You really do.
No. There's two O's in Goose for you.